It's Education Technology Week on Wells Tech. We're talking about Google Apps and Chromebooks and cell phones. Joining us to do that, not only Sally Draper, of course, but Gail Potratz and Chad Kafka. All that and more coming up next. This is Wells Tech, a podcast on the Streams Media Network sponsored by Wells, Wisconsin Evangelical Lutheran Synod. Your show hosts are Martin Spriggs and Sally Draper. Join the conversation at wellstech.wells.net. Welcome back, everybody, to the Wells Tech Podcast. My name is Martin Spriggs, and you've tuned in to a show where we talk about technology and ministry. And I don't do that alone, fortunately. And today I have two lovely ladies on our educational-focused podcast. One that you're used to seeing on a very regular basis, probably about weekly, and that's Sally Draper. Good morning, Sally.
Good morning, Martin. I was going to let you do it just with our other guest this morning because
you tried.
Sleepy Eye has major internet issues overnight and into the morning. But look at that. They got it fixed in time for the Wells Tech Podcast.
And, you know, the worst part of it is you missed Castle last night.
I did, and that's a pretty bad part. Cable was out, internet was out since about 7:30 last night. Crazy,
how could they do
crazy
that
timing.
To you? That, the humanity.
I know.
But internet is back on, and we're seeing a feed from Sleep Bay. We're also seeing a feed from New London, Wisconsin. Gail Potratz. Good morning, Gail.
Good morning, everybody.
How are you?
I'm doing great this morning.
No internet outages. And
nope.
This is Gail's first, is it your first video podcast with us?
Other than the very first practice one, yes.
Okay, so that didn't count. But this one this one is a keeper. So we're happy that you joined us. We're going to be talking
Thanks.
About classroom technology. And those of you that have watched the show for some, or listened to the show for some time, realize that during the school year, we have one show a month that focuses on educational technology. And we swap back and forth between our semi-regular classroom technology correspondents, Gail being one, and Jason Schmidt being the other. And he will continue to do that this year as well. But we appreciate Gail on. We are talking about a Google product that I've blogged about and was very interested in last school year, called Chromebooks. And this is very timely because Gail is starting a project this year where she's got Chromebooks in the classroom. Correct, Gail?
That is correct. Our seventh grade classroom, we started with one classroom this year of 19 and have projected a three-year pilot program with them where we'll get them into the sixth through eighth grades.
Okay. When we talked about this last year, I put a series of blog posts together to kind of introduce what Chromebooks are. But maybe, Gail, you can introduce us to the device itself. What is a Chromebook?
Well, a Chromebook looks like a laptop or a notebook computer, but basically it runs on the Chrome browser. So it's entirely browser-based, starts up almost instantly because it doesn't have a hard drive to whirl through, and makes itself available to students and teachers alike. Very useful if you're a Google Apps school, which we also just became this summer. So the Google Apps are basically working as the software with our Chromebook hardware to drive the things that we're doing this year.
So when you say Google Apps, that means the whole suite of applications that Google makes available for free through
Right.
educational customers, which includes documents and you know, everything that goes along with that, including spreadsheets and PowerPoint type presentations and databases and forms and those kinds of things. And then it also includes some communication tools and chat, right? So you've got email and chat and those kinds of things.
Correct. We, of course, there's a management console that goes along with the Google Apps, and that allows you as an administrator to choose what products you want to use in your institution. Mm-hmm. And also you can break that out into, you can create groups of users and control the level of use of the different products within groups too, which is nice in a school setting.
Well, certainly from the administrator's perspective, and also the typical administrator within our Wells schools is not just a dedicated administrator. They're usually teaching, probably maybe even full-time in many cases. And now they've got to manage all these devices and then all the apps that run on them. And this administrative console, I found that to be kind of the sweetest piece of the puzzle here. The devices are nice too, for a couple of reasons that we're going to talk about here, but the administration of them is really easy. And then you can set up administrative groups so that the right apps can go to the right grade levels, and it can be done all centrally. And just a real time saver for somebody who normally would have to go around to every computer, set it up, you know, image it, troubleshoot it, etc.
Right. No more imaging, which is a big time saver, I think.
Okay. Gail, I'm curious about the whole implementation process. What it took, you know, from approval of them to actually getting the computers in hand. And then once you had them in hand, what it took for you to get them ready for the students.
Right. Well, that's a very good question. The implementation process actually began well before the devices came on site. We actually got them 2 days before school started this year.
Oh, wow.
Perfect. Which really, that sounds like a time crunch, but it really isn't so bad. I had the Google Apps parameters set up before that, so I just had the devices to set up, and since they're so easy to set up, that really wasn't such a problem. So back up about a year or more, when I started talking to people about the idea of Google Apps for Education being our software for our school, and then investigating, well, actually 2 years before, when I started investigating devices because of budgets is what drove the investigation of devices. I think it's really important to understand that preparation of your staff is key. I would encourage anybody that's going to try to go this route to just start with getting the teachers their own personal Google, you know, the Gmail account and the personal tools. We did that several years ago. So when we transferred from doing our faculty agendas on wikis to Google Docs and sharing that way, that was really a natural and a time saver when we moved into the whole adoption of this as a school-wide application. So that I think was key. The other thing I think that was key is we had a speaker come in from one of the board members has a daughter who's a administrator in a local public school system nearby, and they're doing some innovative things. And we had a speaker from that school come in and speak to us about the changes in education, what's driving education today, and how technology fits into the new educational philosophy of the day. And thankfully, when she was done speaking, I felt really good because most of our teachers reported to the board and the other people who were there and said, well, you know, Gail's been telling us this stuff all along. So that was huge for me, because if you can get somebody else to back you up and you know, not feel like you have to sell this on your own, I think that makes it so much easier. So they were kind of looking at things a little differently after that, because, you know, as much as you on site can do this kind of thing, it really helps people when they hear somebody else from the outside talk about the same things. It's such a verification for them that your people are on the right track. So that was huge. Then I went to the school board and started doing some presentations on what is Google Apps. And then what is the Chromebook? So I did a couple of those where I used a lot of Google YouTube videos, both for philosophy of education and for learning about the devices and for learning about what Google is and how it's going to run on the devices. So did a lot of that with the board to try to educate them as I educated the staff. And so then it comes to, of course, the adoption and the money part of it. So the more of that you do, the more they can understand why we have to put the money toward it. So finally that was done, and then we were able to order them, and we're up and running.
And as I understand it, you went with a Samsung 5. The cost was around $400 each.
Right. It was $399 for the device, but then there's that $30 license on each machine that you pay to Google, and that's what really ties you into the management console and the support is how they...
So the devices, this is, probably can't see it real well, but this is one of the earlier Chromebooks, and it's pretty skinny. This is one from Samsung as well. This has been... this is outdated at this point, but I think it's plasticky. It's not going to survive a lot of drops from a class, a student's desk necessarily. They're not made that way. I mean, and for that price, you can't necessarily expect that. They're not ruggedized. So there's got to be some care. So you have to think about that as you're rolling these out, and at what grade level you're rolling them out, and what oversight's necessary. But other than that, it's got one thing I like about these over a like a netbook. Like a lot of our schools started out with netbooks, is first of all the size of the screen, but also a full-size keyboard and a trackpad. So it's really a regular computing experience versus this, cramped, tiny experience, which I don't think is good for the student or the teacher. So it's got a nice 13-inch screen and, full keyboard. They've made some modifications to the keyboard. So you have a search key, for instance. You don't have a caps lock, and there are other things specific to web surfing across the top, so you don't have the normal function keys. But then, and Gail, I assume you can attest to this too, one of the, I think, big wins for something like this is the SSD drive, which allows for a real quick boot up. So the kids can grab it, open it up, log in, and they can actually log in on any computer. It won't matter which one they grab. And 10 to 15 seconds later, they can open up an app and start working, versus a traditional computer or a netbook. It could be 2, 3, 5 minutes before everybody's ready to do work.
Yep, I think that's huge in the school setting.
And then also, Gail, I think you mentioned that they have a really long battery life, so the kids aren't having to plug in at all.
Right. We, with our MacBooks, we still use the MacBooks in the eighth grade for the one-to-one that we do in the eighth grade. And those are getting older, and yes, we have to plug those in quite a bit during the day, and that gets to be an issue. So it's really nice having these. We have the Samsung 5. Looks a lot like the one you showed, Martin, except it's black. They have a newer one that came out after that, or a bigger one that they usually sell to business rather than education. We looked at that. It's a little more expensive. It's got a little more processor, I guess. But I did not want to even consider it because it has a less battery life. It has like only 6 hours, and this one has, like they say, 8 to 10. We've never had them run out yet, during a whole school day, and they're used pretty much all day.
Yeah. Do the kids take them home at night, or do you keep them there?
No, we did not go that route. When Google Docs is your software, there's really not a huge reason for taking them home. Because
if they've got
a computer at home, they can get to all their stuff anyway. And we didn't really like the idea of sending them out the door on the buses and the whole bit. So we thought about it at first. We modified backward. One thing we did stick with, a little different than some people may do it. It is truly one-to-one in the sense that every person in our seventh grade has their own computer. So even though you can share them easily, we like the responsibility that kids have when it's their own device. We found that to be very good on the Mac program that we ran. We learned that. And so they have their own, and this device will go with them to eighth grade next year. So it's their own thing, and they have it all day long. It's at their disposal. The teacher, of course, always has the the upper hand if they say, okay, there's really no reason you need this right now. I'll put it away. Of course, that's, you know, still in play. But we're not finding so far many problems with really letting them have all-time access.
Mm-hmm. So if they muck it up, then they've mucked it up, and they don't have to deal with somebody else's mess. So.
True. Okay.
Yeah, but it's hard to, on the operating system side, on the software side, to really screw things up because you have control over that, and you know the apps are all web-based, so it's not something that they can accidentally uninstall or configure incorrectly. So
the only thing that really can happen, and it happened once, is when you first get these, you have to, it's called enroll them all, and it's just a little keyboard command that you do that sets things up very quick and easy. And that is an advantage, by the way, of getting them from Google rather than going to Best Buy and getting them, because we looked at pricing all over. If you get them from Google, they come with the number in there that's synchronized with the whole Google system. So you can really, that makes it that easy that you enroll in a couple seconds and you're spending a minute or two with each computer and you're done. You know, you're up and running. So definitely I'd recommend getting them from Google. And you're not going to find lower prices at other places. Believe me, we looked.
Google or an authorized reseller.
Right. We actually got ours from a Promevo, but you work through Google and they hook you up with these other companies then.
Okay, cool.
But what I was going to say is the only thing that we've had, we had one that a nice little picture comes up and says, oh, you got trouble. You're going to have to send this in or what do they call? They have a word for it now. It escapes me. But anyway, I would call it reimaging if I was doing it, but they have a different word. So all you do is you create a flash drive with this on. It's all, you know, you go to a Google site, you put your flash drive in, then you put it into the machine. You put it into a machine that's working. They tell you what to do. You go to the machine that's not working. Now you've got a recovery drive that anytime anything goes wrong, you just put it in and, you know, it's like you put the whole system in again. The kids will lose data if they have data sitting, you know, in there or bookmarks or whatever. But it's like so simple to fix it.
Mm-hmm. So there are some cons, right? I assume that there are some things that you can't do on a Chromebook that maybe you could do on a Mac or a standalone PC.
The biggest one, you know, they're not powerful enough. You're not going to make an iMovie or a Movie Maker type movie on here. So you still need some multimedia machines in your school where you can do some heavy duty work. But even little things like, and I guess it's maybe not because of the device as much as the Chrome browser itself, but there are things you can't do. For example, many of our schools, I'm sure like us, use the Accelerated Reader program. That kids cannot take a test on the Chromebook. Right now. And I talked to them yesterday. They have no plans right now. They have an iPad app where kids can take a test, but they aren't really looking at Chromebooks at going that. Even if you're on a regular computer and use the Chrome browser, you have trouble using Accelerated Reader. But so you have to do something to deal with that. Also, many of our schools use PowerSchool for their school management software. That will not run on a Chromebook unless you go and get a plugin for the browser. It's called RNDR. So if you search for RNDR, and basically that's because you need Java to run the gradebook. And so if you put this browser plugin, you'll be able to do that. So you can make it work, but you know there are things like that that won't work out of the box. But the developers have to put a little piece together to make it work. And I imagine as things move along, there'll be more and more of those coming out that will help remedy some of those situations. But there are some of those things to work around, definitely.
Yeah, and I know that Google was kind of thinking of that when they launched the ability to use Citrix and remote into a server where you can run some of those apps. And I don't know how popular that has become, but I'm sure they're thinking about that. But as these things get more popular and more traction, there's going to be things like that that'll come sooner sooner or later. Speaking of that, Sally, we did a little bit of research, right, as to, you know, what Wells schools are involved with Chromebook Initiative, right?
That's right. I actually tapped into my Twitter network and asked Rachel Pearson, who teaches at Trinity in Waukesha. She was one of our active commenters from the Google Summit this summer that was held at Wisconsin Lutheran College. So I knew she was getting them at her school, and she told me that they actually are piloting with the sixth grade class, Gail. So you went with seventh grade, they went with sixth grade. They have 22 in their sixth grade who have them, and she says the kids are in love with them. So maybe we'll have to talk with Rachel further and get more details about how the rollout went at Trinity. Of course, Martin, you visited with Peter Isles last year. He was kind of the groundbreaker, not just for Wells, but for Chromebooks across the nation. He was one of their original schools that got the Chromebooks last school year. And they're still going strong up at Grace and Oshkosh. Peter was able to share with me that he is aware that they are also using them at Zion and Columbus, Wisconsin, and probably in a few other Wells schools this year. So if you're a Wells school using Chromebooks, we'd love to hear from you and maybe establish a little bit of network with you guys and hear how your school year progresses.
I know the congregation I go to, Peace, is considering those. They had a couple people attend the Google Summit at Wisconsin Lutheran College this past summer, and they use their initial foray into one-to-one computing was these smaller netbooks, which I don't think they're really happy with, and I think they're seriously considering going to Chromebooks in the future as finances allow, and that's obviously a concern. They already have Google Apps rolled out. So that's, as Gail mentioned, one of the first steps to kind of get used to that electronic submission and, you know, working in the cloud. The Chromebooks are just kind of the next step to kind of make that a more seamless experience.
Good stuff. We'll have links in the show notes to Martin's past blog post. I don't know. You got 8 or 10 of them out there, Martin, where you've talked about all different angles of Chromebooks. You came back with some updated pricing information recently in a blog post. So we want to make sure everybody has that as a reference point.
Very good. Speaking of Chromebooks and Google in general, that's the focus of our interview today. We're gearing up again with our interview series, and we got the chance to talk with, make a new friend, Chad Kafka, who, Gail, you introduced us to Chad. What's your relationship to Chad?
I met Chad through my work with the Milwaukee Digital Media Conference. He became an instructor there 4 years ago, the same year that I did, and we enjoyed collaborating on projects during that week. Well, actually, all year as we prepared for that week in Milwaukee. And then Chad actually became the MC for the program the last 2 years that it was held. So
very intriguing conversation, engaging personality. Chad is at the Franklin School District, south side of Milwaukee here. And he's also a certified, I think they call him certified Google educators, as well as Apple certified, too. So he kind of sees both sides. And his job is basically to implement technology in the Franklin School Districts. And they've adopted Google Apps. And so let's listen to our interview with Chad. Chad Kafka is joining us today. Welcome, Chad. Thanks for taking the time to do that. You are the, I'm just reading off your website, so you have to correct me if I'm wrong, the technology coach at Franklin Public Schools, right?
Yes, exactly. Franklin Public Schools, just a little south of Milwaukee.
Okay. Tell us a little bit about what you do there and some personal stuff if you care to share.
Sure. I've been working in Franklin. This is the start of my seventh year, and I started here as a business computers teacher at our middle school. And just through through the different years had amounts of time that weren't scheduled for teaching where I would help out with technology in the building. And that grew into this technology coach role, which I'm now in full time. I do a lot of integration in the classroom with teachers during team planning. We plan out different activities and try to figure out how to incorporate technology, the hardware and the software into the classroom.
Sounds like a cool job.
Yeah.
One of the reasons that we wanted to get you on the show is that a number of our schools are beginning to implement or at least think about Google technologies. One obvious reason for that is that a lot of the services are free and our schools like free, and I'm sure
right.
yours do too.
Right, definitely.
But a lot of them are taking it kind of to the next step, which is, one-to-one computing and getting computers in the hands of the students. So maybe tell us a little bit about your experiences there at Franklin in that regard.
Sure, definitely. We don't have a one-to-one yet. We've thrown it around. We're focusing more right now on kind of bring your own technology. We're calling it our BYOT program. Apologize if it gets a little loud and assembly just let out in the hallway there.
No, you're good.
Okay. At the middle school here, it's a building 7th and 8th grade of about just under 700 students. And over the last few years, we've really built up our laptop infrastructure where we have just different carts. Our students are in a house system. So we have 3 houses at 7th grade, 3 houses at 8th grade. So a few years ago, we got a laptop cart per house. We've slowly been adding on to that with more carts just so that we can share them where needed and when needed. This year, we started a new math program, which requires a lot of online participation by the students. So we have some Windows laptops in the building now. So we don't have pure one-to-one, but we're getting closer. With that came the challenge of wanting to make sure no matter what the device is, that we want our students to be able to have a consistent experience. So last year we rolled out Google Apps to our students here at the middle school, 7th and 8th grade. And I was the leader of that. And we did it by house, which was kind of nice. So it was kind of a rollout, slowly over time. And with that, the students got a Google account. They got Gmail. They got their Google Docs, which is what we've been using primarily the most. And going back to that consistent experience that I talk about, we wanted the kids to be able to get to their files anywhere, anytime, here at school, at home. We love the ability of being able to easily share files to teachers as a way of turning it in. So we've kind of built up a little consistent practice for doing that where students will share a folder to their teacher as a way of whatever they drop in that folder, that's how they kind of turn it into the teacher. So we've been loving using Google. We are now using it more at the high school with our 9th through 12th grades this year. And one of my projects in the district is I'm in charge of kind of opening it up going backwards. So now this year I'm starting to work on a plan for 6th grade and hopefully 5th grade and working backwards across our 5 elementaries.
Okay. So you're a Google certified teacher. Why Google? Why did you kind of dive in that direction when you had, other technologies? You had Apple and iPads and all that stuff. There's
sure.
other options, of course. Why Google?
Sure. Well, I'm actually funny that you mentioned that because I'm also an Apple Distinguished Educator. So I seek out any chance I can to kind of just learn more and go and be a part of these networks where I can learn from other educators that are doing things with these tools. 2009, I applied for the Google Teacher Academy, and how it came about was I had just heard about it on Twitter. I'd seen people talking about it and I was like, oh, what is that? I'll check that out. And basically what it is a program. It's put on as a joint program between Q, which is Computer Using Educators. It's an organization out of California. They run a lot of conferences and do a lot of professional development. They partnered with Google and they started running these Google Teacher Academies around the country where they would just open them up every so often. And now they've even gone international where they let educators apply. You have to make a 1-minute video around a specific topic. At the time, the topics were motivation and learning or innovation in the classroom. I believe they've added a third topic now. I think the third topic has to do with community, something with community. So you make a 1-minute video showing what you're doing and what you would do if you were to become a part of that network. They accept around 50 people and you travel to one of the Google offices around the country. So mine that I was accepted to was in Washington, D.C. It was just a great experience to have a day and a half. It was a day and a half professional development. The first day was literally one of the friends I made there, Danny Silva, who's now in charge of running the Q professional development, he had said it was like they turned down a fire hose and just shot all this information at you. And that's really what it was. They had people there from Google. They had people that were lead learners that had been previous Google certified teacher inductees. And we just went through the tools and talked about how you can really use these in education, how you can use them with students, how you can use them in the classroom. We learned tips and tricks. It literally was just a bombardment of just all this great knowledge. The second day was just a half day where we just kind of did it unconference style, and you had all these great educators in one place. And so we just kind of said, okay, I want to run a session on showing you some resources for using video in the classroom. So let's go do this session over here. And somebody else would run a session on a different tool over here. So that was just a great opportunity as well, getting to just kind of digest what others were doing from all around the country. Mm-hmm. So with that, when you're accepted into the network, we have a Google group that we all are participants in, a discussion board online, where we're constantly throwing out questions to each other, sharing insight into how we're doing things in our school. The charge with becoming part of that network is that you will go Google Apps either at your school or help another school to kind of get up and going with that. So continually learning, presenting at conferences, things like that. It's just a great network to be a part of. We communicate through Twitter a lot. So if you want to follow a hashtag to kind of see what we're talking about, the hashtag is GoogleCT. And we can probably throw that in the show notes for people.
What does CT stand for?
Google Certified Teacher.
Okay.
So the CT, yes, is for Certified Teacher. Another good hashtag to follow that I follow a lot is AppsCT, and that's the Apps Certified Trainer group, which is separate from the Google Certified Teacher group. So yeah, that's pretty much it in a nutshell, the Google Certified Teacher group, just educators. Doesn't have to be a teacher, could be administrators. I believe the next one coming up is is in New York, and I think it's in about 2 weeks, and I'll look it up while we're talking here. They have a hashtag where they've been sharing. The people who got chosen for that have already been sharing, and they're going to share while they're there. So it's not just the people in the room, but hopefully share out some tips to
awesome.
Others. Yep. There is an application open for one in Mountain View at the end or in early December. And I believe the deadline for that is October 4th, if I remember correctly. If you search out Google Teacher Academy, it's the first hit that comes up, and you can apply through there if you're interested.
Cool.
Yeah.
So it sounds like really a cool path that you were on. You did this conference, you said, in 2009, and then you
right.
rolled out Google Apps last school year to your school. So tell
right.
us how it's going. Have you hit pitfalls or all the bad stuff behind you and you're smooth sailing now or what?
No problems whatsoever.
Awesome.
No, <I'm sorry. laughs> not any big problems. I really was worried about how we were going to get this out to 700 students. There are school districts that have rolled this out to even more. You want to, when you teach this to students, you also want to teach them some of the things that are the right ways to do things, some of the digital citizenship, some of those things that maybe not only would make them more efficient, but help them to understand you have access to the world through these tools and just understanding that and hopefully not misusing it. When we went through it, we did a pilot with One House first, and we ran that last fall for about a quarter of the school year. And through doing that, I worked very closely with those four teachers, and we planned some specific projects where we thought, okay, let's use Google Presentation for this, and let's really dive in and see what we need to teach kids going forward. We've also been branching out a little bit. I have some teachers that want to use some of the other tools that fall under the Google Apps umbrella. So we're starting to experiment with that a little bit with Picasa, the photo program, and Blogger. And so I'm really tapping into the different networks out there of other educators that are doing that just to get ideas so that you kind of have that forethought of what's good to do, what's best practice, what might, you know, create some hiccups, where will kids take this and possibly abuse it and try to address those things up front.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah.
Cool. So positive reactions from student, teacher. I mean, you're getting adoption, basically. They're looking forward
definitely.
To using the stuff.
Yeah, they are. And the teachers at first were a little hesitant. If you didn't understand how Google's tools work, you know, understanding that your document is online, those that aren't familiar with that might initially think, oh, anyone can see it. And I mean, they can't. Your stuff is private to you. You control how you share it to others. So kind of teaching the staff and informing the staff how that worked. What really helped last year in our building, and I would encourage this in any school that rolls this out, is our administrator, our principals really pushed this. Walked into a meeting the beginning of the year. We got a new assistant principal last year who had used Google as a teacher himself with his students the year before. And in the first meeting he went into, they're passing around a paper agenda, and he said, no, we're not doing this. We're going to do this as a Google document. We're going to keep it all digital. We all have laptops with us that are portable. Let's really live in this world that we're trying to get our kids to work mm-hmm. in. So I think having that administrator buy-in was key, because it I don't want to say it forced the staff, but it did force the staff to really, if they weren't getting there quick enough, it forced them to have to get there in order to understand how to work there.
Okay. So I have a personal question, my sure. own personal question. My wife and I were just talking about this last night. She teaches eighth grade English and literature.
Okay.
And they just started using Google Apps and just starting submitting assignments or asking the kids to submit assignments via mm-hmm. Google Docs.
Right.
So she now has to correct these things. And she really was not happy about the process. She says, I can do this 10 times faster just printing this out and writing on a paper.
Sure, sure.
What advice are you giving to your staff there? If you want to keep this totally digital,
right?
You know, how are you inserting comments? I mean, I know you can insert comments and highlight and all that other stuff, but
right.
that takes a long time, apparently.
It does. It does. One of the tips I would give is learn your shortcut keys to make that process quicker.
Okay.
Because the process is, you know, if students are turning files into you, you have to open those on the computer screen. You know, you have to read through it. If you want to comment digitally, doing a comment could either be the mouse going up to, you know, insert comments and then typing it. Or if you learn the shortcut keys, I know on the Mac, it's Option Command M.
Yeah, I found that out last night as I was trying to work
exactly.
with her, 'cause I'm trying to encourage her. Yeah, just keep going. But
right.
Yeah, that is one way. So you click a word, you double click a word, and then you know that key combo will open it up. Sure.
Exactly. And then one of the other tricks we learned, I forget exactly what it is, but when you type a comment and you want to end it, rather than having to go back to your trackpad or your mouse and actually click the submit the comment button. It was something with the enter key. It was either shift enter or control enter, and that ended the comment. So you could just create a process for yourself to move through the document quickly. Another tool that's built into documents specifically, we did this last year with our language arts teachers, because it was the same from them too, of, man, I have to look at this and what do I do and how do I mark this paper up easily? There's a tool in Google Documents that looks like the little paint roller.
Yeah.
And if you're not familiar with it, what it is, if, as an example, we had one language arts teacher. She wanted to mark if a kid had maybe had done something wrong in a sentence. She just wanted to mark it as red text. She didn't want to have to go highlight, go choose red all the time. So in that document, if you highlight something red, then if you I forget now. I'll try to open it while we're talking here and play with it. If you double click the paint roller, that allows you to, that's called the paint format tool. So it allows you to take whatever the format is for that text. And then as you go down, if you see another word, rather than having to create that whole process again, it's almost like you copied the format from that first right. red text, and you can just click on text and it'll just make it red. Mm-hmm. So it's learning those efficiencies that can make it go quicker. It is quicker to print it and handwrite and scribble all over it and hand it back. But if you're really trying to push for kind of a paperless classroom or putting this where the kids can see it, you know, rather than waiting for the teacher to have to hand it back, you know, as soon as you see it, it's in the kids' file already. So,
right.
So yeah, it's a learning curve. It's definitely a learning curve.
Absolutely. I think there's probably all kinds of things like that, depending on the subject matter and the teacher's preference too, that you have to overcome. And that's probably part of your job, right?
Yeah, it is. And just and finding ways. I mean, okay, that doesn't work for you. Let's find some other way. And if there's not a way and we keep beating our head against the wall, well, maybe we go back to that original way, you know?
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
Great stuff, Chad. We really appreciate you sharing all that great knowledge. I'm guessing that you have online resources and other recommendations for us. You gave us a few Twitter hashtags already.
Sure.
Can you tell us more about other resources you might recommend as teachers are getting more into the ed tech frame of mind?
I can. I think if you're not on Twitter, even if you just lurk on Twitter and you learn what a hashtag is and being able to search for things on Twitter, that's where the conversation's happening. So that's the first thing I always recommend people go to. In our district, and I'll give this to you for your show notes, we just built over the summer, the other tech coaches in the district and I, we had our resources all over the place. We wanted to really put things in one spot. So we've been building, we just call it our Franklin Tech site. And in there, a big part of it, a big subsite of that is Google and Google Apps. And as we find things, we're putting them there. We're creating our own videos, our own helpful videos. I do a lot of screencast recording myself. So I'll put a lot of that there. I'll give that to you for your show notes. Trying to think of other resources I've gone to when I've had to search something out. There's tons of discussion groups. If you have a Google account, Google Groups, if you search there, I think there's just a generic teacher group with teaching with Google tools. So definitely joining a discussion group and getting ideas from others. Usually the first place I honestly go to is I search something out and I try to find it, or I go to Twitter and see what people are talking about.
Yeah. Google Ed has an account on Google Plus, and I follow them there. Yes. And they have some good stuff there occasionally.
Yes, they have been. That's a great resource. I actually have noticed that on Google Plus more and more, that they're sharing some great stuff there.
Okay. And if people wanted to learn a little bit more about you and what you've been talking about, you have a website, right? ChadKafka.com.
I do. Yeah.
And we see your Twitter yep. handle there as well. You also are involved with another podcast, right? Mobile Reach?
I am. Yes, I do a podcast called Mobile Reach, just as a plug for just an educator network. If educators are looking to tap into other resources, edreach.us. And EdReach is just basically educators putting out podcasts, putting out blog posts. We thought the thought in the beginning was, we've got all these people blogging and doing things all over the place. Why not bring them together in one spot? And so I do Mobile Reach there. I'm a co-host with two other educators, and we share specific uses for mobile technology in the classroom: iPads, e-readers, Android devices, iOS devices. We don't discriminate, and we try to bring about just different uses, things we see that we do in our roles. All of us are tech coach type roles or tech directors. And they got the new logo up. That's I hadn't looked at the site recently. We just posted a show last night, so they got our new logo up there. So it's a great resource. There's a Mobile Reach show. There's a Google Educast. I'll give them a plug. They just talk about Google in general, and they tell you what's new with Google, and they also relate it to the classroom. Those are just educators talking about how they're using Google. And you could find us through iTunes or listen right at the website. If you're not familiar with RSS feeds, if you subscribe, it pulls in every new episode that goes up, and just a lot of great resources there.
Cool.
Google Educast is another place I go to. I listen to them whenever they put their shows out, and they usually are on top of whatever's new.
Very good.
Chad, thanks so much for taking the time. We realize you got a busy schedule, and
no problem.
I've added you, and I've followed you now on Twitter, so I'm going to keep up to date on what's cool going on in Chad's life and work there. So
great. Again, let me give you one other thing real quick. I just thought of here.
Sure.
Coming up in November, and since this is where our show here is based out of Wisconsin, the Midwest Google Summit is taking place in Wisconsin Dells. And I'll give you the link for the show notes as well. It's a second annual one. We did one last year. I'm presenting there. It's just educators coming together and sharing how they're using Google tools in the classroom. It's taking place at the Wilderness, I believe. And it's a Sunday, Monday, Tuesday. It's the 13th, I think. Does that sound right? Let's take a look here. November 11th, 12th, and 13th. So if you're interested in going to a kind of a more face-to-face type of thing, definitely search out the Midwest Google Summit.
Awesome. Good. Maybe we'll see you there.
Yeah, definitely.
Thanks again, Chad. The resources that you provide are great. If you are interested in following Chad, chadkafka.com. And maybe we'll circle back and see how things are going maybe in 6 to 12 months, if you're willing to do that.
Definitely.
All right, cool. Thanks, Chad.
Great. Yeah, thank you.
Our thanks again to Chad for taking the time out of his busy schedule to talk about Google with us. And that's a fun, Sally and Gail, that seems like a fun job to have, right? To be able to introduce that stuff, but not without challenges too.
Right. Yeah. I think he, like most people, Chad, his background is education. He was a teacher first, and that's where most of us that do a lot of this, started. And I think it, you get to a point where it's been so beneficial for you that it's just fun to bring other people on board with it. That's the excitement.
Yep. Yeah. I was quite impressed at how much he shared with us and followed up with a long list of links. So you guys have to check out the show notes because Chad was very generous in all that he shared with us. And you'll want to visit the links that he shared.
Okay. And even check him out on YouTube. He's got quite a lot of educational videos. I use a lot of his things for training purposes and whatnot. So check out his YouTube section, too.
Cool. All right. Thanks again, Chad. Let's move on to ministry resources. And the ministry resource that I'd like to share today is actually a request of our users, and that is
our listeners.
Yes, our listeners. Well, if I want them to become users.
Yeah.
That is the Wells mobile app, which I've been working on for the last few months or over the summer now. And it's ready for beta. So and this is a web app, so this is not an app you will find on iTunes or the Android Play Store. It is web-based right now, and eventually it will become an app, I think, on all those platforms. But I'm starting out on the website, which is good enough for now. But so if you're interested in testing out the new Wells mobile app, which basically brings all the Wells.net content to your phone, including a couple other features like a church locator and integration with Facebook and Twitter, those kinds of things. I would love your feedback. So if on your phones, if you've got a phone that supports mobile, you can go to m.wells.net, and Sally's holding it up there. There it is. That's on the iPad screen.
Mm-hmm.
And you can see that you've got, the read icon, audio, video, Wells radio, Synod reports, the call reports on there, social, blogs, location, a way to contact us. So if you wouldn't mind becoming a tester, we're going to be in beta probably for about 2 or 3 weeks. And I would like your feedback on things, on bugs, of course, and then feature requests as well. So this is my first stab at mobile development, so please keep that in mind.
Be
nice. But constructive criticism is absolutely welcome, and I would love for more than just me and a few others to kick the tires on this so we can make it better and then launch it in a more full way. There are some things that aren't as they will be when it finally launches, and you'll see those. For instance, we on the radio side, we only have basically one working channel, but if you go to Wells.net, we have, you know, five radio channels. So there's a few things that aren't totally converted yet, but for the most part, the things that are there will be there. And if you want to email me with your comments, martin.spriggs@wells.net, that would really help us out. So m.wells.net. You can also go to mobile.wells.net and then test it out.
Awesome. Right. I'll sign up to be a beta tester. I'll let you know what I think.
Awesome. There is no pay. only thanks. So appreciate it. So let's move on to our picks of the week.
Gail, maybe you should lead us off with picks of the week this week.
All right. If I can remember which pick I picked, I'll be glad to do that. Okay, the Mapmaker, yeah. A Mapmaker Interactive from National Geographic Education. I picked this one just because, well, right now our seventh graders are working on a Google Maps project, okay? And we do use Google Maps a lot. I like it. It can be flaky sometimes, like everything. But this is just a real neat alternative. Working in the world of Google is great, but I certainly don't want to limit people to that. When you're out there on the web and you have programs or applications like Animoto and VoiceThread and some of the great educational sites to go to, those are still a huge part of what we're trying to do here. I don't like people to get the idea that, you know, Google is all encompassing. If we do that, we're good to go. Because there's a lot more to the world of education and kids than just that. And that's why I threw this one in there, because the National Geographic Foundation and their education is always very solid. This MapMaker Interactive has some pre-done things that you can call up on it. You can call up some of the places where active volcanoes are currently, you know, you can see the most current eruption in the world and where that happened and that type of thing. There's overlays that you can put on the map. You can create a map from scratch. You can. So this could be something a teacher could create ahead of time and use as instructional tool, or it could be something kids could create, work together on and create a map to show something. It lends itself very well to kids and understanding places in the world and events in the world.
Mm-hmm. Remember, Gail, when we had the maybe many of our schools still do, just the number of rollable maps that show a lot of these different things right in the center of the classroom. You know, right. Here's the picture. Here's the map of Asia. Here's the topographical map. Here's the now you got it all with a single click, right?
And you had those big white overlay sheets on those too. You could overlay some things. Yeah, this is a lot easier.
Great,
and not as heavy.
Yeah. Exactly. A little more portable. Yeah. And you bring it up on a Chromebook too, I assume. So I assume free, right?
Yes. Okay. Yes.
And probably very customizable. So maps are huge. It's obviously natural for computers. They get data and you throw this data in, then you can do all kinds of cool things with it. So my geography teacher's dream.
Yep.
That leaves the next one up is Sally.
Yep. And I actually have a pick to share from my friend Richard Byrne, who's at Free Technology for Teachers. I don't know if we've talked about Richard lately, but great site. He's constantly finding great resources to share with teachers. The web address is freetech4teachers.com. And recently he blogged about Money Metropolis and Financial Football. And these are websites sponsored by Visa, I believe, and where kids can play games about earning money, saving their money towards a goal, budgeting, those kind of things. So in this Money Metropolis game, the kids pick what they want to save for. Maybe it's for a new dog or something like that. And then they walk around town and they get jobs. And and typically those jobs are like games. So maybe cutting the grass for someone will earn you X number of dollars. But if you don't do it well, if you run over their trees and their plants, then you don't get paid. So you have to play the game
That's
the right
life.
Way.
Yeah. Right.
And then there are also kind of temptation things where they could spend a little money and, you know, dip into their savings and not get to their goal as quickly because they want something or whatever. So a real good practical application. And I would bring up the website, but it does crank out some serious music and I can't find a way to turn the sound off. So beware if you're using it in a classroom setting, make sure the kids have headphones, please. There's another one, similar concept, called Financial Football, where they answer questions about budgets and savings and spending and things like that, and they move their football team down the field. So being football season and all those great football fans we have out there listening, maybe this is one you want to check out as well. And again, very professionally done and, you know, sponsored by Visa, so I think you'll be impressed with the resources. And we'll have links to both those games in the show notes.
Hey, Sally, I have one question for you on Financial Football.
Mm-hmm.
If they have replacement refs in the game and they make them play, do they still get paid?
Ouch.
Yeah.
Yeah, we're still hurting.
For those that don't follow the Packers, I'm sure you've heard about it as well. So.
Yeah.
All right. My pick is actually in keeping with my Wells Mobile pitch, and that is a phone. I recently upgraded phones, and I had a choice to make. I had the iPhone 5 had just come out, so that was available. But I had been using Android for some time, so I decided to stay with that. And iPhone 5's chief competitor is from Samsung called the Samsung Galaxy 3S. It's been out for a little while. And I have to say that it's one of the best phones that I've had. It's bigger than one that I've had before. It's got a 4.8-inch screen. And let me turn it on here.
Wow, that is big.
I've got the mobile app there. Yep. But it is skinny, so there's not a lot of heft to it. It's lighter than any other phone I've had. Comes in white or blue, so if you're not white or blue, then you're probably looking at something else. One thing that I like about this versus the iPhone or previous phones recently that I've had is the removable battery. So I can get I can take the back off and take the battery out, and because phones, especially smartphones with larger screens, have some battery challenges. So I can usually get through a day with this without much problem, which is good because that's kind of, I do a charge at night. But if I'm on the road or whatever, on a plane, it's nice to have an extra battery along so I can swap that out. It's available on all carriers plus U.S. Cellular, I guess. So that's five or six in all. And it's got Siri-like replacements. So it's called S Voice on Samsung, where you can talk to it. It'll do what you ask. Works pretty well. The price is similar to every other smartphone of this size or scope, and that's $199 with a 2-year contract for 16 gigabytes. This does have a SD card that you can put in, so you can get extra storage on this. 4G, so that's nice if you're in a 4G area like I am. And just a nice quality phone. I would say I haven't really touched the iPhone 5, but I suspect it's not quite as nice as far as the finish and such, but works for me. And I like the openness that Android provides, and has really come in handy with testing the Wells mobile app. Just a plug here for those of you that maybe aren't aware, ShopWells, if you are especially a call worker, you can get great discounts on Verizon. I just attended with my wife, Debbie, a 30-year class reunion, her 30-year class reunion from Luther Prep or Northwestern Prep at the time, and one of the pastors there said, hey, I just saved $300 off my bill for the year by switching to Verizon's plan. He was already on Verizon, but wasn't part of the Synod plan. So it's usually about 22% off the monthly bill and accessories, so it's a really good deal. So if you're not aware of that. Also with ShopWells, we have AT&T as a partner, and that's not just for call workers, but also for any Wells member can take advantage of that, and I believe that's 25% off. So just keep those in mind if you're in the market for a smartphone or a phone in general. More and more people are getting smartphones, and maybe the Wells mobile app is the reason that you're going to get one now. But the numbers are kind of astounding at the growth of the smartphone market. Over 50% of all phones sold today are smartphones in the U.S., so it's a growing trend. So if you're in the market for one, I would highly recommend the Samsung Galaxy S3.
Very good.
Okay. Should we move on to picks of the week? Or no, I'm sorry, we just did that. How about if we move on to community feedback?
Okay, that sounds like a great idea. And for those of you that listened last week, you may remember that a question had come up on the Wells Tech Listserv. Wells Tech Listserv is an email contact group where people can ask questions of other techies in the Synod and typically get great response. So it's always a good group to tap into. And one question that came up recently was about using a flat screen TV for digital signage. So maybe in your school entryway, I know they have one at Minnesota Valley Lutheran High School where they have messages flashing up on the screen on a regular basis. Other people have talked about potentially using them in a church narthex setting where they have kind of the bulletin announcements playing in a scrolling fashion of some kind. And so the question was really about the hardware side of that. And then it turned into, well, what about the whole flashing message thing? How do you do the sign, the content that goes on the screen? And I was just overly excited about the response that Eric Paulson sent in. Eric is at St. Matthew's in Oconomowoc, Wisconsin, and he shared that what he's done is set up
internal server of sorts.
Right. He says he has a mini PC connected to a 48-inch monitor that automatically launches Firefox on boot and loads their digital signage page. And that's basically a web page that he designed with using frames, HTML frames, allowing four different content areas on the page. And he didn't just share the fact that they have this page. And let me just flash up for those of you watching the video. I have the page loaded. This is kind of what it looks like. He has an area that has a scrolling slideshow kind of thing where they have pictures and things. He has the calendar pulled in. He has some weather and time information pulled in. And that is just an awesome example, a great idea for anyone that wants to set these up. But let's go to the top of this page and note, and I'm guessing this is probably a Google site. It looks like a Google site on their domain. But note that he's documented thoroughly their digital signage. He has it spec'd out as far as pixels, how each area is designed. And then he provides every bit of coding that goes into each one of the sections of the digital signage page, which is just amazing. Mm-hmm. And so amazing that another listserv participant, I think it was Carl Henslin up at St. Mark's in Green Bay, took the information and immediately created a digital signage page for their school. And so this is their live page that I'm showing on the screen, and they have four sections, just like Eric had kind of spec'd out, and they have kind of a photo slideshow with information showing here and their Google Calendar showing and things like that. So practical information that was shared on the Wells Tech listserv that was immediately put to practice up in Green Bay. And so if you're looking for a solution, I highly recommend that you check out Eric's page and the excellent documentation that he provided.
Little DIY on the Wells Tech listserv.
There you go.
Awesome. Thanks,
love
Eric.
That
That's awesome. Yeah.
So next up, we're gonna scoot through some DIGO links that were provided on our Wells Tech group. But there are a lot more that we aren't touching because there was just a really long list of links shared this week. First of all, the panoramic virtual tour of the Smithsonian National Museum of Natural History. I think it was Tom Rosenau who shared this link, and his comment was that it was just like being there, almost as good as being there in person. So check that out. Also, he shared a link to the Google Art Project, where they've taken high-res imagery of major artwork around the world and shared them on this website. So you can go into different collections that are available there, and you can even add to the Google Art Project with your own artwork. So,
yeah, my wife uses this in her classroom. She teaches art. And one feature she really likes is the ability to really zoom in. So you can kind of see brush strokes and real close up, maybe a lot even closer than you could even if you were viewing the art in person. So,
wow. It's amazing, isn't it? All right. Then a few more to share. BibMe, our friend Jason Schmidt, added it again to our Wells Tech group. It's something we've talked about in the past, way back in 2010, but he said, I just wanted to pull this one up again. Good for schools that may be starting research papers with students for the first time.
Yeah, I see MLA, APA, yeah, all kinds of different formats.
It's basically a bibliography maker, and I don't know about you, Martin, but that was probably the hardest thing about the whole research paper thing was making sure you put the commas in the right place and all that kind of stuff. And BibMe will do that for you. You pick the format, you paste in maybe a link to an online resource or, is it called IBN number from the book or whatever?
ISBN, right.
There you go. ISBN. And it'll create the bibliography for you. So excellent resource.
Cool.
I also wanted to share a link to Bitcasa. Have you heard about this one, guys? This is one that I tapped on the Wells Tech DIGO group because it basically is offering infinite storage So this is different than a Dropbox or Box.net or Google Drive thing where they say you have 5 or 10 or 50 or whatever gig you have. You notice they say it's 7.99 EB.
EB.
And that's, is that extra byte? I don't know what that is. It's something big because it's virtually unlimited.
Exabyte, I think
exabyte.
It is.
Exabyte. There you go. So,
and I don't know how big that is, but it's bigger than a gigabyte, I assume.
Right. And they say, you know, it works on your mobile devices. You can access it from anywhere. You can share things. You can make things public, instant download, all that kind of stuff. They've got some, you know, positive reviews from CNET and PC World. They mention in the review area, $10 a month. I didn't find pricing anywhere readily available on the site. It just says make an account, but apparently maybe it's $10 a month. I did see it in those reviews. So,
well, $10 a month for infinite storage, that may not be a bad deal for some.
Exactly. So I think this might be one that we check out. So I'll let you know if we end up as BitCasa users.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Okay.
I don't know if you guys noticed, but you can now update your Twitter profile to include a bigger header area. Let's see if I can bring mine up. And I do have a blog post from Twitter to kind of go over the changes. Basically, they've made it more mobile friendly. So instead of having a long, skinny header area, they've made it more of a rectangular header area that's
A little more creative.
Right. It's got kind of imagery behind it, maybe taking off on the Facebook timeline header area or whatever. So your picture still shows there, or whatever image represents you on Twitter still shows kind of centered over it, your tagline, as it were, linkage and things like that show, but then you can put a larger image behind. And you can do this on your Twitter profile. Let's see if I can get there and just show you. If you go into settings, there's a tab called design. And on the design area, now there's this this header where you can change it. And they actually say recommended dimensions of 1200 by 600. So you upload the header in that area. And when I went there, it was blank. So if it's blank, then you get the longer, more traditional Twitter header. So this is something new. It looks really nice on a mobile device, comes across really well on mobile. So check out the blog post from Twitter, and then you may want to consider changing your Twitter profile to have a new header. All right. And then finally, a link from our friend Ryan Rosenthal, who shared a link further down this DIGO page to the Educator's Guide to Copyright, Fair Use, and Creative Commons from the EduBlogger. So copyright guide with links to lots of great resources. And I don't think this is an area that we can ignore or one that we don't want to be up on the latest about. So if you're an educator, check this out. Understand about fair use. Understand about resources that your students can use in the classroom safely and that kind of thing.
That's got to be an ongoing, you know, challenge for teachers to teach on, not just the ability to source your work, but understand copyright and derivative works and you know, get that in the heads of their students when it's maybe not all that clear in the head of the teacher. Because, you know, with the Internet, it's a changing landscape.
Right. Absolutely. All right, Martin Spriggs, you're up. You had a couple of things to share as well.
Oh, sure. Ran across a blog post on Mashable, which is a site that I follow. And one post that was intriguing that I shared was entitled 7 Essential Apps for Grade School Students. So this is a little blog post that highlights just 7 apps that could be used on a smartphone or a tablet or whatever that grade school students may. And I'm seeing more and more grade school students with iPod touches and, you know, even iPads. And if not, then maybe they're using their folks or, you know, kind of a family one. So there's a number of different apps that are available here. One called iWriteWords, great for younger children, teaches your children handwriting while playing fun games. Britannica Kids, Solar System, Park Math, a math app, called Stack the States, help kids learn state shapes, geographical locations, capitals, flags. Really, app development is kind of taking it to the next level, and they're recognizing, boy, this is a platform that is very engaging for kids. And so you're seeing a lot of these. So some of these blog posts are helpful for you to discover what might be available. So
I must be a kid at heart. I thought the state one looked like a lot of fun.
It did, didn't it?
Might have to check that out.
And I also shared on Google+. I follow Google in education. That's keeping with our theme of Google Apps and Chromebooks, and they come across with a lot of good hints about how to use Google Apps and Chromebooks and such. And they put out a blog post today announcing or reminding everybody about Google Code-In 2012. Young coders age 13 to 17 are available or can participate. Code-In is a contest in open source software for pre-university students. And Sally, you're aware of this, right?
Yeah, actually, I've had a son participate for the last 2 years. He has Google Code-In t-shirts from 2010 and 2011.
Oh, cool.
And basically what you do is go online and they have a list of jobs on different open source platforms. He's worked on Tux Paint jobs. He worked on a platform for, I don't know how you'd even describe it. It was like a software hardware combination that people use in integrated systems that's been to the moon and out into outer space on NASA projects and all kinds of stuff. And he did some flyers and things. So it's not all coding. You can do graphical stuff. You can do like tutorials. That's what he did for Tux Paint, like a video tutorial that he recorded explaining some of the different components of Tux Paint. And as you do it, if you do one project, you get a free t-shirt from Google. And then for every three you complete, you get $100. So last year he got a Google Visa card in the mail with $100 on it for completing three projects. It was very cool. And then you can earn up to $500. And then they typically, for the kids that just are out the wazoo with these projects that just work the whole time and do tons of them, they'll take the top three or four and give them a trip to Googleplex out on the West Coast and stuff. So they get a chance to go see Google firsthand and stuff. So it's a really neat thing. And like I said, it's not all about coding. You know, if you're a Java programmer as a kid, you can get some work to do there, but they have different areas that you can be involved in. And this particular son of mine is really into digital design, and he's learned a lot about GIMP and other programs in the process of doing these projects. So
cool
stuff.
Very good. All right. Sally, we have any more feedback?
I think that will do it for this week. I'm sure there's more out there, and we'll try to include it all in next week's show.
Very good. And speaking of next week's show, that's one of our seven best. That's an ongoing series we have throughout 2012. We are picking the seven best of something. And in October, that seven best is the seven best member, prospect, and student management tools.
Yeah.
And so if you have any input to that, we would love to get that on the show. So if you have something that you use to manage your membership or your students in any kind of organized fashion, it can be low-tech, high-tech, whatever, tips, tricks, applications, let us know so we can get that on the show. That's going to about do it. Gail, thank you very much for joining us. I appreciate your insights and blessings on your work there in New London and with your new Chromebooks. That's exciting stuff.
It is. It's a lot of fun.
Okay. And Sally, thanks as always for all the work you do. Let's close the show with the music of Janine Dennis. It's actually instrumental, Celebration Medley. I think you'll enjoy it. Thanks, everybody, for joining us. We'll talk to you next week.